Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED Public Radio and the California Report, and your moderator for tonight's program. Today's program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. Today's discussion will focus on high-cost beneficiaries. We will attempt to answer the question, is our healthcare system failing those who need it most? A small number of individuals, most with complex health conditions, account for a majority of the cost for providing care in California. These individuals, the frail elderly, those with multiple chronic conditions, including mental health and substance abuse problems, can benefit from a high-touch coordinated system of care that not only increases the quality of care they receive, but also reduces the high costs of seeing them. This panel will try and provide some answers as to how those individuals can receive the care that they need. I want to just first introduce our panelists. We have Dr. Margot Kuchel. Am I saying that right?
You are.
Margot Kuchel is an associate professor of medicine at UCSF. She is a practicing general internist and an NIH-funded health services researcher. Her research interest is on interventions to improve the health outcomes and decrease reliance on acute care in homeless and other highly vulnerable populations. Dr. Kuchel received her AB from Harvard, her medical degree from Yale, and completed her residency at UCSF. So she's no slacker. Next to her is Dr. Cheryl Phillips. So a lot of doctors here. So if anybody falls ill, we'll be okay. Dr. Phillips is the senior VP at Leading Age, an association of 5,700 not-for-profit organizations dedicated to expanding the world of possibilities for the aging. Prior to coming to Leading Age, she served as chief medical officer of OnLock, Lifeways, which serves nursing home eligible seniors in the greater San Francisco Bay Area. She's a past president of the American Medical Directors Association, an organization for physicians in long-term care, and past president of the American Geriatric Society, representing healthcare professionals who care for seniors. And finally, Dr. Brad Stewart is a general internist and chief medical officer of Sutter Care at Home, a Sutter Health affiliate that provides home care and hospice services throughout Northern California. He founded the Advanced Illness Management Program, integrating home and hospital-based care for patients with late-stage chronic illness. Dr. Stewart was the primary author of Medical Guidelines for Prognosis in Selected Non-Cancer Diseases, adopted in the mid-1990s as National Medicare Hospice Eligibility Criteria. Dr. Stewart also was featured in the HBO documentary Letting Go, a hospice journey. Brad, actually, I'd like to start with you. We've known about this population for a very long time, these so-called high-cost beneficiaries, people who are the frail elderly, people with mental health problems who perhaps are homeless, dual eligibles, as we'll talk about, those who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. So help us understand why our healthcare system is failing these people in the first place. What isn't it doing to care for them to make sure that their medical conditions are taken care of?
Well, thanks, Sarah. First, thanks, everybody, for coming. And this is a huge and growing topic, and we really appreciate the support of CHCF and everyone involved with putting this together. I think the answer to your question partly resides in something you said toward the end of that question, which was, how are we not filling these people's medical needs? And I think the mistake that we're making is we're assuming that their needs are medical. I think that they are to a degree. And the fact that they're high cost reflects that they're showing up in our hospitals a lot. So clearly there's a lot of medical need. But I think the real question is, can we solve that problem by focusing primarily on just their medical situation? I think the answer clearly is no. And I bet we spend a lot of our time tonight talking about the other elements that are important. And I'm going to just right away launch into the fact that many of these people are so ill that they're nearing the end of their lives. They're not dying because we can't tell. Often until that happens that it's going to occur. But we fail completely to find out what it is that they want. And I think one of our primary innovations is pretty simple. It's find out what people want in their personal lives and then tailor their care to suit that.
Give us an example of what you mean by that you've done with some of your patients. Yeah,
in our program, in our advanced illness management program, we try to focus on people who are very, very sick and tend to call 911 when they have a problem. So in our program, we try to serve them at home and find out what it is that they really want to key on, and then we get on the same side of the table and line up behind that. I'm thinking of a guy named George who had heart failure, lung failure, and a bunch of other things that people like that tend to have, kidney trouble, diabetes. He'd been in the hospital two or three times a year before we picked him up. We had him in our program for 5 years. He never went back to the hospital and wound up dying at home. He was on hospice for a short time at the end. But his primary personal goal when he entered the program was I want to be able to walk to the dinner table and have dinner with my family. Mm-hmm. He never mentioned anything about the hospital or any of his medical needs. And so we wound up giving him support in ways that allowed him to be independent, happy, comfortable, and stay home. He never went back to the hospital for that last 5 years. And I'm sure he did turn from a high-cost beneficiary into a more independent, self-supporting, and family-supported person. Really, we need, I think, more of a social work approach than a medical approach to a lot of these people, so that we can keep them from having to become patients.
Dr. Phillips, can you talk a little bit about some of the, at Leading Age, some of the kinds of services that you find? You know, I'm sure there's a whole list of services that people really need, but when you think of the sort of the hit list, the top three or four or five things that somebody needs to have a graceful ending, if you will, what comes to mind?
Absolutely. And one of the areas, and we'll talk a little bit more about, is a population called the dually eligible. Now, that's a label that we in healthcare systems tend to give to people, because I've never seen anybody introduce themselves as, hello, I'm a dual. But the dually eligible population.
Hello, I'm Abdul.
Yes. are those individuals who both receive Medicare, either from disability or because of age, and Medicaid because of their socioeconomic status. It turns out that this group that we label as duals actually have some very explicit risks and costs. Just as a comparison, a Medicare person who is dually eligible on average spends about $14,000 a year in Medicare benefits, whereas a non-dual, a person who is Medicare alone, spends on average $6,500. Just by that designation, it seems to be a marker for a population of risk. And I absolutely agree with everything that Brad is saying. And there is a group of this population that actually aren't actively dying or even in the process of severe illness, but are quickly getting there because we have a very broken system, both in payment, in communication, and in fragmentation. So one of the areas that we focus in, there's actually a number of ideal models, and I like to say ideal because they're small scale, but they're great laboratories. Probably the best is, and there are several representatives here in the audience, is my former organization, Unlock, which was the originator of the PACE program of all-inclusive care of the elderly, which identifies a group of seniors, 55 or older, who are nursing home certifiable, but who receive payment from Medicare and Medicaid. But the wonder about this program is it integrates payment, but it integrates the social functioning issues, housing, transportation, meals, social isolation, with the medical component that turns out to be not the first thing on people's agenda. So when you can integrate the care of the person across the continuum of their needs, not our service, but across their needs, and integrate financing, you can actually do some very amazing things.
So, Dr. Krishal, I wonder, at the general, I imagine you see lots of people who walk through the door who have uncontrolled diabetes, who have heart disease that's not being taken care of. Talk a little bit about what it's like to try and talk to a patient like that, who has complex medical conditions, who may either be homeless or at least has a tenuous living situation, how you talk to them about trying to get at least the medical side of things under control, knowing that there's all these other social components that may be outside of your control at that moment.
I mean, I think one of the reasons that the healthcare system is failing these patients is because of that. I can spend 15 minutes as a primary care provider talking to a patient who's homeless, try to simplify their medical regimen, do what we're taught to do in medical school as appropriate thing to do for someone who's struggling with homelessness or substance use or mental illness. But none of it is really getting at their primary problem, which is that they're going to take care of their immediate needs first, and their immediate needs very well may be finding a place to spend the night, finding food to eat. And so I think what we try to do is we try to, while we're trying to simplify their medicines and make it easier, make sure that a $5 copayment isn't the difference between they're getting medicine and they're not. Make sure that they can read the medicine bottles that we're giving them. We do all of those things, but I think really when we're effective, we actually get at the other problems. And I really think that things like housing are healthcare, and that we spend a lot of time trying to get people linked up with housing programs and things so that they do have the mental space to even begin to think about their other problems. I think we ask an awful lot of these patients, many of whom are struggling with lots of different problems that fall under lots of different, you know, psychiatric, substance use medical care, physical medical care, which is paid by different paying streams. We're all kind of separated from one another, and we ask the patients to be the glue when really we should get our acts together and be the glue to make their jobs. They've got a hard enough time getting through the day.
And, of course, this comes just as the state continues every year to try and close what is a growing budget deficit. This year we're seeing, and over the last several years, we've seen cuts to the in-home supportive services program, which pays people, I'm sure many of you know about this, but pays either family members or somebody else to come into the home and provide some basic quality of life care, helping you shop and bathe and those sorts of things, as well as the adult day healthcare centers, which advocates are now estimating about 95% of them are going to be closed by the beginning of next year, since the governor just vetoed legislation on Monday, it was, that would have essentially restored about half of the funding to a sort of a cobbled together network. So I wonder if maybe we'll stick with you, Dr. Kushal, just if you can talk a little bit about these are the exact kinds of programs that you're talking about. And yet the state is saying we don't have a dollar to give and they're to get a dollar back from the feds.
Right. I think this is often the conundrum we wind up in, that we find effective programs and then we lose them because their funding stream isn't secure. I think it's the case where a lot of the times who is paying for the program isn't necessarily the person who might be reaping the cost benefits, so they don't see it in their interest, because we have all of these different systems of care. We know that, you know, the IHHS program and the adult day health are really critical for our patients to stay safe and stay out of the hospital and out of nursing homes. We're losing them. We've had the experience of having some really great programs for high users who are in sort of homeless, substance user, people with mental health problems that have shown success but then be shut down because they don't have a designated funding stream.
And Dr. Phillips, is it your sense that there is, I mean, I think people are empathetic in California. I think the governor and many lawmakers felt these cuts are devastating and will have a devastating effect on a lot of people's lives. But I wonder in Washington if you think there isn't this sense of, well, you just need to, and I'm from New Hampshire, but pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, I did it, so why can't you? A little less sympathy for people in this kind of situation.
I certainly acknowledge that we have a financial crisis and a debt crisis in this country. And the mindset, now that I am on the Washington side of the conversation, is that entitlements are somehow driven by people who should otherwise be making this work for themselves. The Medicaid population in particular is, I think, a very poorly understood population. When I speak to folks on the Hill, there is this belief of non-working people who somehow want to access benefits when they could otherwise be fully able and working. The reality is 2/3 of spending goes to seniors. Of that, over 2/3 of those are cognitively impaired. This is, you know, telling a 92-year-old Alzheimer's woman to get out there and buck up and work is kind of silly. The other problem with this is that while we're looking at entitlements as something discretionary that we can elect to not pay for, the default is really expensive and really stupid, frankly. my editorial bias, I recognize. But what ends up happening when you don't have the integration of housing and the coordination that Margot talked about, when you don't have the focus on person-centered care and person-centered goals, the default is the emergency room in the hospital. And we don't eliminate that by eliminating the programs. So right now there is a frenetic energy going on to look to see where cuts are. And I realize this is a tough time for our country, so I'm not being blind. But the kinds of cuts that we are talking about now make the California budget seem pale.
Dr. Stewart, I want to turn to you. It's so interesting. You're working inside Sutter Hospital trying to get your patients not to use Sutter hospitals.
Right.
So talk, if you can, about just...
That makes you popular.
Yeah. Oh, we forgot to invite Brad to that strategy. So I wonder if you could talk, actually, about how you have pushed forward this model inside a for-profit hospital company.
I'm smiling at my wife because there are a lot of meetings I don't get invited to. But no, you know, I was thinking as my two compadres here were talking about how things are different now. This really the last year and a half to 2 years inside forward thinking health systems from the way they have been since I can remember. I've been in medicine for 33 years, and half of that was spent practicing, and the other half has been in hospice and palliative medicine. I think the difference is that those healthcare, those hospitals and systems that are looking toward the future understand that there is nowhere to go but down if we continue the way we're going. Because what's happening is that older, sicker patients who are mostly Medicare get fairly poor reimbursement. When you come in the hospital, you get what's called a diagnosis-related group, DRG payment for your hospitalization. And you don't make much on people, the population we're talking about, the older patient with heart failure, cancer, the payments aren't that great. Every time the person comes back to the hospital and becomes a patient, they tend to stay longer and longer, but the payments is the same. So the losses on Medicare are mounting in hospitals. That doesn't mean that many hospitals don't want to get all the patients admitted they possibly can. Thinking is still out there. But systems that are looking ahead are realizing that when you lose money on Medicare and make money on private insurance patients, that's called cost shifting. The handwriting's on the wall about that approach. Health plans are under the gun also. And so if we don't work to reduce the number of people who run to the hospital when they don't really have to, we're in for serious trouble. And I think the systems that understand that and are willing to take action to do something different are the ones who are kind of leading change.
So the patient that you described, that when you went in and said, how would you like this to essentially, how would you like to have a quiet ending to your life? And he said he wanted to be at home. He didn't want to have to go back to the hospital. How did you get paid? Did Sutter get paid for any of that work?
No. Well, I shouldn't say no. And also, I want to go back to the way you asked that question. That's really interesting. Because one of the reasons we started this program back in the 90s was that I'd been doing hospice for years. And that question that you just asked, how do you want your life to end? Mm-hmm. You don't ask people that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless they bring it up. Because people just don't go there. People naturally want to maintain their health and their independence and their happiness and their at home as long as they can. So you never say, how do you want to die?
Of course.
You don't even say, have you thought about dying, until people are really ready. Mm-hmm. So actually, our program is a lot about teaching the staff to sense when people are ready to begin to go there. And until then, you don't talk about that. Instead, you talk about basically how are you doing in your life and what is it that you yourself want.
Okay. A lot of elderly people, though, oftentimes feel like they're pushed into going to the hospital, that they have a daughter or son or their spouse or their own doctor saying, we're going to get you back in. We're going to do another colonoscopy.
Yes.
So if you're not having that conversation explicitly with them about sort of costs and benefits, not necessarily financial, but just costs and benefits to the person
Yes. The conversation that I have in Washington with people who are there are like this conversation we're having now. The conversation I have with people in their homes is a very different conversation. I think what it boils down to is if you ask people who have thought a lot about this and ate and slept this problem for years, you'll hear that we need to prevent unnecessary and unwanted hospitalizations. They're fantastically expensive, and there's more and more data showing that they don't really help.
In some cases, they hurt.
The worst infections you can ever get in the world are gotten in hospitals. That's only one. Medical errors. There are many reasons why you don't want to go back to the hospital if you can help it. Decreasing unnecessary admissions is, I believe, impossible. That's what got managed care into trouble. In order to figure out what ahead of time, upstream, what hospitalization is unnecessary, you need a crystal ball, or you need to be too smart than anybody. And that managed care tried to do that. It put in the hands of gatekeepers trying to decide what was necessary and what wasn't. And I don't believe that's ever going to work. That's called rationing, because it is. On the other hand, preventing unwanted admissions is not that difficult. And it turns out most people don't want to be admitted to the hospital until they're so ill that they can't, there's no other place to go. So create a program, and these, now to get back to your question, these programs are not funded yet unless the person qualifies for home health, and home health happens to be doing this program, and very few agencies are. Working with people to see how to head off those crises so that the 911 call isn't necessary. It's not rocket science to do that. In fact, I think social workers are as good at it as nurses or doctors. That you can, like we were saying, you can tell what people need and want. And that's what patient-centered care is about. But myself, I get a little irritated when I hear patient-centered care because it's us providers that always use that term. We're thinking of people as patients. Come on. I mean, people are people who would rather not be patients. And true person-centered care means, I think, getting out there in the home and the community and developing ways to get people what they want and need. And lo and behold, that costs a lot less to fund those teams and prevent the hospitalizations than it does to run people to the hospital.
Dr. Phillips, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this new Office of the Duals in Washington that is that came out of health reform. Do you see promise in that effort, or is this sort of yet another office that has been started that is going to take decades for us to realize any of their great ideas?
And there may be a little bit of both, but I do see promise. What the Federal Office of Coordination, we affectionately call it Office of the Duals, recognized what I was talking about, this dyssynchronous, frankly, schizophrenic relationship between Medicaid at the state side of payment and Medicare. And we all, as clinicians, we got really good at figuring out who paid for what in what setting and doing things because of the payment rather than what the person needed. That's the wrong way to deliver person-centered care. It was expensive, redundant, fragmented, chaotic. And if you're the person trying to navigate in the middle of that, truly, God help you. So the Office of the Duals has now said, let's look at a state's level, the ability to integrate these payment structures and look at some pilots. And some of them are integrating it through care delivery, such as Vermont, which is doing some remarkable things with housing with services, and using Medicare and Medicaid dollars identified at vulnerable populations, but not in traditional medical structure ways, like Brad was referring to. Other states are looking at it through integrated payment models. California is one of the 15 states that was elected to test out some of these models. Now, there's been a lot of pushback about what California is going to do. California is looking at it in a series of pilots related to managed care-like structures. The concern that I have, and now I'll speak in just an editorial bias, we know that this population that we've labeled duals, that I already started out by saying they don't call themselves duals, is not a homogeneous group. They are not all alike. There are younger, physically disabled individuals who are otherwise quite healthy, who can be dually eligible. There are older people who are not medically complex but happen to be poor and Medicare, so they're dual. And then there's the very complex, frail, multiple comorbid conditions. The concern that I have about our state payment model that's going to look at managed care is, can these managed care providers truly put together this continuum of service? Is it just a matter of integrating payment, or is it really connecting? We use the acronym home and community-based services, but is it really connecting with the kinds of things that Margo was talking about? Because if you aren't addressing housing and housing with services and transportation and where they're getting food and can they even manage their medications and are they even leaving their single residency occupied apartment, if you're not dealing with those components, then merely integrating the financing for how their medical bills get paid, it won't be the answer. So California has some laboratory studies to do, and I'm excited with the potential because at least the question is there. And it starts with integrated financing. I think that form does follow finance. But I think the real challenge will be is, do healthcare delivery systems, the Sutters and Mercies and UCs of the world, think beyond the emergency room in the hospital and start thinking about truly that integrated world that the person is experiencing that is really going to make this, the term now is shifting the Medicare cost curve. That's sort of a graphic picture. But it won't happen by widgeting the medical costs alone. It will happen if we start integrating the spectrum of community-based care.
Margo, I want to, this actually tees up a question from our audience here today. They ask, how can we best encourage or incent the people who need it the most to take an active role in managing their health? Diabetics, changing behavior, monitoring their blood sugars, et cetera. You deal with that every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people ultimately want to be healthy and they want to make good decisions. And I think it always is best to start with a bias that your patients are trying to do the right things and to try to figure out what barriers. I don't think anyone wakes up in the morning and thinks, what I really want to be today is sick. It just doesn't really happen. And so I think it's trying to maybe look beyond our framework of how we see the world and thinking about, well, you know, my dad has diabetes and he takes his medicine, and to try to make, I think there's sometimes with these frequent user patients, particularly those who are dually and triply diagnosed and homeless and use the ER, there can be a little bit of this sense of the patient is the enemy. You hear in the healthcare system people like resenting patients or feeling like they're just making bad choices. And I think the programs that have worked have really slowly built trust and try to really find out what the patient wants. And I think it's not very different from the frail elders mm-hmm. going into hospice. The context may be different. The patient may be living under a bridge and hearing voices, and that's obviously a very different situation. But, you know, I think, you know, you start by trying to build trust and try to find. And the case management programs that have shown success have really had a lot of time to spend with people and to slowly build trust and to slowly get to find out the hook for the patient. And sometimes that hook is something that is completely out of the medical system, but is just enough to get the patient engaged. And so we talk a lot about engaging patients. And usually once you do that, and once you take care of their first order of needs, which are usually finding a place to sleep and finding food to eat, because people will always worry about that more than their hypertension medicine, then you can start moving on. But I think if you go at it like, why aren't you taking your medicine, that just isn't a very effective way to do it.
It reminds me of, and I'm sure many in the room are familiar with this, that, and I know many other cities do this, but I was just in L.A. County talking with them about the top 100 that they were trying to get off of Skid Row, basically. They're top 100 users in the county, and they have basically put all of their resources that they can, housing, mental health treatment, substance abuse, all of that, literally towards these people, and they all know them by name. So another question from an audience member, Dr. Stewart, I want to direct this at you. Much of what we're talking about here, the sort of integration of social services with medical services, is very common, obviously, in a lot of European countries. I was just in France, actually, doing a story about their maternal and child health program there, which has been focused on prevention for 65 years, and they have one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world. But it's all based on sort of a shared principle that the French have, although there's debate about whether or not they can continue it, of solidarity. You know, it's literally in their motto, right? Egalité, fraternité. And I wonder to what extent the question is, why does Europe have these better and more facilities, particularly for elders, the person points out. But I want to kind of pull that back a little bit and ask, to what extent is we can't solve this problem because we haven't really reached some consensus as a country about what role government plays in helping people, for elderly or homeless people or hearing voices. We haven't really reached a consensus about how to help them or whether or not it's our responsibility to help them.
Yeah, that's just a huge question, and I'm not smart enough to answer it, but I can dance around a little bit. I think, this is America is the land of the free and the home of the independent brave soul. And, sharing resources with others, sometimes isn't our first priority. Planning in such a way that the most vulnerable will be cared for and resources will be allocated to that, that's not always something we put as a high priority. If you look at the debate right now around balancing the budget, you can see that in action. And I don't really want to go down that political road too far. The comment I want to make after 30-some-odd years of being frustrated, well, I should say 20 years of being frustrated at not being able to change that culture, or medical culture for that matter, I think what works and what our data is showing actually does work is changing the structure of our care from the inside. And Lord knows my hair isn't this color because I've, loved every minute of being inside the system. It can be really, it can be feel like pushing a big rock uphill for a long time. But if you change the structure of how care is delivered at a micro level in a way that gets most parties what they want and need, and we happen to stumble into a financial catastrophe as a Western world a couple of years ago, you have a pretty interesting combination of factors that might lead a country to begin to do things differently. I think healthcare reform passed because we realized collectively that we cannot continue down this road. It's too inefficient. Costs are spiraling. We're not on top of that yet. But I think what works is to start doing things differently with people who are dedicated to doing that. And our experience is that spreads. And it starts with people like you and people like you. People who believe that we've got to do things in a different way. And we now have a world where ideas that just a few years ago seemed like they were dreams, and dreamers are not popular in practical places like medical systems until recently. Now there's more receptivity to new programs and new ideas, as witness the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which a lot of us are hoping is going to really follow through and bring new things forward and scale them up and create sustainable new ways of dealing with these problems.
Dr. Phillips, I wonder if you could actually talk a little bit about to what extent you think there are all these innovations in Medicare and pilot programs all over the country that have been shown to work. What extent do you think those can actually migrate into the private system as well?
I'm very optimistic, and I'll not to be hopelessly naive and too Pollyanna-ish, I also recognize that innovation rarely emerges in times of comfort. Because why change? Things are already kind of good. Right now, with our fiscal issues, it's almost too chaotic. And what I'm finding is that people that are providing care across the country are so terrified about just being in existence in the next 6 months that being innovative is like moving the chairs in the Titanic. So we need to move somewhere in the middle that I have enough of a burning platform to need to invest in new thinking. And I have the impetus and the intention to actually do that. I think the solutions absolutely are out there. We have the ability. It's estimated that 1/3 of Medicare expenditures are wasted. They don't improve anybody's care. It's not that it's fraud. It is that it is for services that don't make people better, that are redundant, that are duplicitous, that are just unrelated to outcome. So if you could eliminate just even half of that, There's a hunk of change for all the things that we're talking about. That elimination will happen through new models where the incentives are not driven to churning of the process, but actually being responsible for populations across settings, for defining wellness that includes the person's view of their own wellness across their continuum, not ours. So I am optimistic. And I think that some of the innovations, our challenge is to get enough evidence. All of us have small little islands and pilots. In my former life, I too worked at Mother Sutter. And I had a very difficult time taking model programs and replicating them even within the organization. So our challenge on the private sector side is, do we have aggregate evidence? Can we demonstrate models that are truly effective across settings? The PACE program that I made reference to at the beginning is a very good example where we do have evidence, and we now have 75 PACE programs across the country that started out as a demonstration pilot here in San Francisco. So as we look to gathering that data, the Center for Innovations is the right laboratory headquarters, because they can gather in that information, they can look at models that are meaningful and start to replicate them. That's where the private sector will make the investments.
So you mentioned the statistics of one-third of Medicare payments are considered to be unnecessary. And I wanted to ask you, Margo, as a doctor, you see Medicare patients?
I do.
Do you have a sense of what care you're giving that is unneeded, or are you one of the good ones that
never make a mistake ever?
That's something that doctors will say. I don't know necessarily that the care I'm giving isn't going to be effective.
Right. I mean, I think it's often hard. 20. You know what do you say? Retrospective 2020 is perfect. If you look back, you can say, "Oh, I wish I hadn't done that." And it's sometimes hard going forward. I think we can all do our best to follow, evidence-based guidelines and do that. But I think a lot of the 30% or 33% comes in, when the patient shows up in the ER and they don't know that you've in fact just scanned them at another, that they're getting the same test twice. And this is where, hopefully things like, better information technology, better communication, because I think a lot of it isn't, some of it is that we're doing things that should never be done, because it should never be done, but sometimes we're just replicating what's already been done because one side doesn't know what the other side has done. And I think, particularly in a, for our patients who often have very chaotic lives, you're really more at risk for that because it's even harder for them to necessarily, it shouldn't really be their job to say, oh, really, my psychiatrist just drew my blood test for my diabetes, as opposed to me doing it. If I don't, they don't know that, I don't know that. And so I think that we often duplicate things because we just don't know.
So in the Healthy San Francisco program in San Francisco, that the idea, of course, is that patient would have a medical home and that you'd be able to look at these records and see across the clinics. But there's actually an interesting question here from an audience member. Brad, I want to direct it towards you. It says, the question is, are there any suggestions for high utilizers of the system who receive care at multiple hospital systems? Since hospitals are reluctant to share patient data and HIPAA basically prevents them from communicating with each other.
Yeah. And you all know what HIPAA is, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's nodding. Wow, that's I was kidding. But we have
maybe
a very
just for
savvy
our radio
audience
listeners who aren't here and aren't as bright.
Yeah. Sharing medical information is tough, but the Dartmouth Atlas people have studied this, and it turns out that 75% or 80% of patients are what you might call faithful to their hospital. There are doctor shoppers, and there are people who go from system to system, and there's a lot of leakage. Systems like Sutter worry about services that are provided, and then people go other places, and it's like you mentioned, it's wasted energy and money and time. But most of the time, people kind of stay close to where they go. And I think that's the whole basis, in fact, for this accountable care organization idea that's trying to get some traction now, that you can create systems that have patients dedicated to them, and you can do something about those people and really change their care and change their lives. Can I go back, though, to something that you mentioned a second ago? It's this idea that's so disturbing to people that a third of the money we spend in Medicare is wasted. I think it's important to kind of peel that apart a little bit and take a look at it, because it's not just that we duplicate MRIs and, you know, do the 10th mega workup when the person hits the emergency room. It's really that a third of what we do to patients doesn't really help them. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's important to make that distinction. It's not waste in the sense that, you know, we're doing something for the third time. It's that if you look at, say, you measure functional status, how much a person can do for themselves, and you watch what happens when a truly ill person hits the hospital, they frequently come out worse than when they went in. And functional status, in turn, is a pretty good predictor of mortality. So what it turns out to be is that often we will send people to the hospital, do everything we're trained to do. There aren't any villains really here, I mean, with a few exceptions that I won't go into in detail. But very few people are doing a bad job. We do what we're trained to do. We just don't yet realize that that style of intensive, invasive, aggressive care was designed for the conditions that we were seeing 100 years ago. Trauma, complications of childbirth, serious infections, things that can be cured. Our whole hospital-based system was created to treat things that you could cure. Chronic illness is now 80% of our dollars are spent there, give or take, and they can't be cured.
So give us an example of a patient who goes into the hospital who has uncontrolled diabetes we've been talking about.
Right.
Tell us what's being done to them by this overly aggressive but well-meaning physician
okay.
that shouldn't be done
okay.
to them.
Okay, I'll give you an example I can remember from my very own practice.
That you did.
That I did. Oh, gosh. I mean, I wouldn't be doing this today if I hadn't started to feel really bad about some of the things I was doing myself. A woman in her 80s with dementia, Alzheimer's, who had had several episodes of pneumonia. It turned out that was happening because she wasn't able to swallow properly, and so some of her saliva actually, a lot of organisms live in your mouth, and it was going into her lungs, and she was getting pneumonia. We call it aspiration pneumonia. Because she wasn't swallowing well, I got talked into by one of my gastroenterologist colleagues putting a feeding tube into this patient because she wasn't eating properly. In my own defense, this was years ago before we had studies that now show pretty clearly that putting feeding tubes in demented patients doesn't do anything. It doesn't extend their lives, doesn't increase their comfort, doesn't decrease their incidence of pneumonia. But I did it anyway. And I probably admitted that same person to the hospital three more times until she finally died. And it was early in my career. I never sat down and talked to that person's family and or her. And there are ways to communicate with people who don't use words because they're demented, and I hadn't learned that yet. As it turned out, if I had done that, we probably would have provided a whole lot more for care at home, less in the hospital. And other data is showing that taking a less aggressive approach, a palliative approach, or even hospice care, actually helps people live longer than putting them in the hospital.
Dr. Phillips, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, and there's, again, getting back to this 30% or a third of waste, it's not volitional acts of omission or commission. But another good example, and many of you have heard of this data, but there was a study that came out that showed that Medicare beneficiaries, people who are on Medicare, this was not just the frail elders, but all Medicare folks, 1 in 5, after they've come out of the hospital, go back to the hospital within 30 days. 1 in 5. That's not ideal care. Again, it's not because anybody did anything wrong or that anybody gave disregard. But even more significant was that half of those never saw a physician before they went back to the hospital. So that speaks more to a discoordinated and very fragmented system, and each one of those hospitalizations are incredibly expensive. One can say that's part of that dollar that didn't help that person who went back to the hospital, but if you saw them in the emergency room, you wouldn't turn them away. Mm-hmm. So the term unnecessary hospitalization implies that people are like, you know, punching a Magic Kingdom card to go because they want to hang out in the emergency room, which is not the truth. In the nursing home, there was a very important study that was reported by the Kaiser Kaiser Family Foundation that looked at Medicare persons in the nursing home. In many areas, as many as one in three get readmitted within 30 days. What they found, though, again, was if you had family discussions, anticipated goal planning, focused on people's symptoms, you decreased that readmission to the hospital from the nursing home significantly. And Georgia did a wonderful statewide study looking at this. Again, not withholding care, not rationing care, not telling people you're old, you don't get care, but focusing on what was the appropriate care at the appropriate setting. That's the kind of expenditure that we're talking about, that there's the opportunity to improve. I don't believe in withholding services just because people are old, or telling somebody you need to have a treatment that I said you should or shouldn't have, but we just default to the hospital as if it's the only place.
I mean, in some ways, too, there are these perverse incentives in the system. A nursing home doesn't get paid more when their patients get sick, right? So I've heard from nursing home directors, I ship them off to the hospital because that's where they get cared for. The hospital gets paid, and then they come back to the nursing home.
Yes.
This is true. And there's a number of forces. Right. So there's also families who believe that the only safe place for care is in the hospital. So there's a family expectation. Yeah. There's a staffing, both in terms of the training and the number of staff in many of these settings of care. And they're equally challenged. And you're right, the incentives are all wrong. Nobody wakes up in the morning to do the wrong thing, but form does follow finance, and thus we get what we pay for, as has been said over and over again.
Before we move on, I'm sorry, I have to do my duties here as the moderator and remind our radio audience about that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's discussion focuses on high-cost beneficiaries and whether our system is failing those who need it most. Our panelists are Dr. Margot Kuchel, Associate Professor of Medicine at UCSF School of Medicine, Dr. Cheryl Phillips, Senior VP at Leading Age, an association of 5,700 not-for-profit organizations dedicated to expanding the world of possibilities for the aging, and Dr. Brad Stewart, General Internist and Chief Medical Officer at Sutter Care at Home, a Sutter Health affiliate that provides home care and hospice services throughout Northern California. I'm Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED Public Radio and the California Report in San Francisco. Margot, you wanted to respond?
I was just... I was just reflecting. I had just been on the inpatient service at the General, and that issue of feeding tubes came up. When you put the feeding tube in, we didn't even know that it was the wrong thing to do, and now we know it's the wrong thing to do, but it seems counterintuitive, and I was just reflecting on the amount of time that my team and the nurses that we work with spent with the family trying to explain to them why we wouldn't recommend feeding grandma, basically, and why this wasn't actually going to improve her life and her goals. And, we're very lucky to have a wonderful new palliative care service at the General who had a lot of time as well. And we spent hours and hours and hours with the family in order to clarify what we knew in our guts. But they weren't saying they really wanted the feeding tube. They were saying that they wanted to care for their family, but it seemed wrong. It seemed like we were withholding something that they wanted. And I think in terms of the incentives being misaligned, we often are not paid for time in that way, and that those conversations take a very long time. It takes a certain level of comfort talking about uncomfortable things to do, and it can be very hard to get it done, even when we do have the evidence to know. And you can see how often the easier thing would be to just do what winds up being an unnecessary or even harmful thing, because it takes less time.
And I wonder if all of you can address this issue of what's the number of years it takes for a proven method or approach to actually get instituted, right, by the vast majority of physicians in this country? It's something like a decade.
Yeah, the estimation is close to 10 years. And even then, even when there's excellent evidence, it looks like we tend to do it about half the time.
Why is that, Dr. Stewart? Why is that? Physicians are just stubborn, or they just have a lot to do and they can't keep up on their medical journal reading?
Physicians stubborn. Let me see.
Let's ask his wife.
You're asking three doctors.
I think stubbornness is one way to put it. I think what happens is medical training instills in us a very strong conviction that we know what we're doing. And, they'll tell you when you go to medical school, I remember hearing this and it impressed me, that in 10 years, half of what is in your textbooks will be obsolete. The problem is we don't know which half.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. We get started doing things, and it's very hard to keep up and get retrained fast enough to know what you're doing. But that's why I think new programs that don't require physicians to change anything, but that take place outside hospitals, in patients' homes, can accelerate the process a lot. I listened to what you said, and I thought back to all those agonizing conversations I had in hospitals with people where, in the heat of battle, it's really hard to be sure even what the right thing is. Mm-hmm. So you do what you're trained to do, and also you take the least risky way, which is to do everything. Nobody ever got sued for doing too much, okay? And that's a factor. On the other hand, once you're out of the hospital, assuming you've survived to discharge and you graduate and go home, that's where we can then intervene either by phone. I work with people who have programs that just work by telephone, or go see the people at home. And once the heat of battle is behind you and you're in a place where you can have some clarity of mind and some calmness, over time, over repeated conversations, people can become a lot more clear about what they actually want. All of you sitting out there are healthier than people that we're talking about. Most of the people in the population in this high-cost beneficiary group are so ill that they have trouble even getting into the office to see a doctor, and when they do, it can take 10 minutes to get down the hall in your walker. It's hard for us, and I'm including myself, to understand or even imagine what the choices are like when you get really sick.
This next question, actually, from an audience member, speaks somewhat to that, which is the reliance on emergency medical services to come pick people up. Margo, if you could take this one. They ask, the emergency medical services are often the point of entry into the healthcare system for a lot of patients. Do you see a role for EMS in triage of these patients and considering options other than a trip to the hospital?
I do, but I think it's also... it's been somewhat controversial and difficult. We have set up a sobering center in San Francisco where people who have problems with, we call them chronic inebriates, or people who have severe alcoholism and drink frequently, come into the hospital a lot, where they can go someplace to become sober, to be in a safe spot, and to be perhaps engaged in treatment if they're ready for that. And the EMS are authorized to, based on some medical characteristics, if their heart rate isn't too fast or if they're alert enough, that they can go there instead of the hospital. But it's scary because you don't want to be wrong. And there was some pushback and some concern. I think, EMS has been great about it, but I think it's complicated. So I'm in support of it, but I think it will be a hard, difficult transition.
This is more of a comment than a question, but if you have a response, anyone on the panel, the person says, Kaiser has integration, of course, e-records, chronic care programs, hospice, palliative care, pharmacy, labs, so on and so forth, home care, rehabilitative services, all these things. This medical home model that works, not perfectly yet, they say, but even Kaiser doesn't fund discharge continuity, which they have as a policy based on Medicare law. Or Medicare regs. They take Medi-Cal patients. I'm not following that. Are the duals getting better care there, I guess, at Kaiser? Well, let's go back to this question, though, that you would have a system sort of, in a way, as ideal as Kaiser, and yet they're not, apparently, according to this person, doing any kind of continuity after they've been discharged out of the hospital. Dr. Phillips, do you want to take that?
I would love to tackle that one. So Kaiser is a good example of an integrated service delivery system. Those are all those fancy words we like to throw around. I used to believe that integration only meant that they had common letterhead, not just Kaiser, but many healthcare systems. As long as they use the same letterhead, it must be integrated. The disconnect there, and I think that the author of this comment raised a very good point, that yes, the medical care, Kaiser is a fairly good model of integrated medical care. It isn't a terribly great model, I will say, for the very frail elders, because it focuses much more on a wellness prevention and a younger population medical model, but a very good medical model, so I'm not here bashing Kaiser. But it stops at the discharge. And I think there is, while it's true that Medicare doesn't pay for these services out in the home and community the way we're talking about, what Brad had raised earlier, and part of the opportunity with some of these integrated models, is when the healthcare system starts to care about what happens after discharge, and that, in fact, the best hospitalization is the one that never happened, that's a whole different way for hospitals to think. Then organizations like Sutter, Mercy, Kaiser, the UC system will start thinking about populations and say, what is it that I need to do as a healthcare system, either at the time of discharge, once they go home, or maybe if I know about them and they haven't come into the hospital yet? Oh my gosh. A head in a bed is the way hospitals are paid now. As we start thinking about populations and integrated models, truly integrated models, we're now going to start thinking about healthy populations and how do you keep people out of the hospital. So the ideal Kaiser model, to take this, would be a Kaiser system that invests in community-based care coordinators, on meals programs, on not only Medicare home health, but home care. Maybe it's bathing services, maybe it's transportation, but it looks at a vulnerable population and sees where that group is most at risk for decline and invests in resources. If you have a payment model that looks at an entire population, which is what the accountable care organizations ostensibly are trying to do, I'm not here to promote the ACO model, but if you look at a financial accountability for a population, all of a sudden it starts to make financial sense to a healthcare system to keep Martha and George healthy at home rather than sick and in the hospital. Our old model was hospitals got paid when Martha and George were sick in the hospital. We want to change that.
And just to add two words to that, healthy at home applies just as much or more to people who are seriously ill as it does to people mm-hmm. who are young and healthy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was using healthy in a very broad sort of a
healthy,
self-wellness.
Healthy means happy, independent, comfortable, mm-hmm. and as functional as possible. Mm-hmm. It's very possible to do that with very, very ill people.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised, too. A couple years ago, I was doing a story about these accountable care organizations trying to do something on radio about ACOs is not easy. but I had read about this man in Southern California in Riverside who was written about in the American Journal of Public Health, who was a three-doc shop, mm-hmm. and he had managed to do fully capitated. He was an ACO, and he had created these relationships with his local hospital and mm-hmm. labs and other things. And he took on the responsibility financially for all of his patients and had made it work, has been making it work for 28 years. And he said, some years are good, I make money. Some years I don't make money. And it was just interesting to see that you don't necessarily need a Kaiser or a massive system in order to take this kind of approach. Do you think you're going to see, but yet at the same time, then when I went out and talked to other doctors, why don't you do this? They said, well, he's crazy. He's taking on this financial risk. One particular patient could just torpedo him, mm-hmm. As we did see in California with some of these, they were called something different back then, but mm-hmm. physicians who sort of took on too much risk. And I wonder to what extent you will actually see, though, sort of these smaller physician offices or practices innovating, or is it only going to come from big sort of doctors' groups kind of pulling, like a Brown and Tolan, pulling people in?
Right. I think both.
Yeah. I think the dilemma is, do you have the resources to really connect all of the pieces? The other worry that I have about some of the smaller risk bearing groups is I have this theory about creating medical ghettos, that if I am a very small practice unit and I have a few patients and a few of them are getting really expensive, I start to say, you know, gee, Margo, there's a really good clinic down the road and they can take care of you much better. And we did see that in early pay-for-performance in some of the populations that all of a sudden, you know, some of these non-compliant patients were no longer in our practice because we suggested that they go to another practice. I'm saying the aggregate we. So that's one of the concerns about having very small units taking on risk. One of the concerns, and my editorial bias, is the accountable care organizations defining accountable for what and to whom. Mm-hmm. And are you truly accountable to the person and the population? And what does that mean? And is that transparent to the individual who's getting their care in an accountable care organization? To the extent that smaller practice units can do that, I think we'll see an exciting array of innovation across the country. I'll throw in one other editorial piece. We're talking about accountable care organizations as if they're hospitals and doctor groups. What about adult day health centers? What about housing with service communities? What about social work consortiums that are working with homeless? Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about that continuum as part of the answer, then I think we'll truly have community-based accountable care organizations. And one of the things we're doing at Leading Age is leading some pilot thinking in what's called innovative communities. Not just defining them as healthcare systems, but truly innovative communities, looking at a population and connecting the pieces all across the spectrum.
That actually brings us to this another question from someone here. She says, the three of you are doctors and also administrators. Do you think that the healthcare system would be better off if there were more doctors working for HHS, for the Health and Human Services Agency? Do you think the person heading HHS, Kathleen Sebelia, should have been a doctor? And they say, like Howard Dean. But I wonder, to sort of what you were just saying, though, are there too many doctors in the room who are defining this problem as only a medical problem?
Boy, nobody wants to.
I think that is a risk, but I don't think that it's too many doctors. I think that even on the policy side, it's our payment is driven through a medical construct. Yeah. We think about disease and we think about payment for services done to a disease. It's not about people, persons, whole person, and the continuum of their care. And I shouldn't say not and never, because I hate stereotypes and absolutes. But our payment system is based on disease, and it's based on what you do in processes. And that's not just driven by physicians. The policy wonks, I see very few physicians in policy settings. But I will point out that the head of Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is a physician. Don Berwick is a pediatrician.
Who we had here, actually, a couple months ago. Yeah. Another question here says, as more people begin to live longer, will the high-cost beneficiary problem and its impact on the cost of healthcare worsen? What can we do to mitigate this? And I'll add on to that for you, Brad, which is that, of course, we have these boomers who are not just people living longer, but we have this whole boomer population who will soon become, many of them, unfortunately, the frail elderly that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Will we be able to innovate in time? To be ready for them when they're another 20 years?
You're asking a whole series of questions. So question number one, will the aging of our population make this problem more of a problem? Yes, it already is. This is the year that the baby boomers start turning 65 and hitting Medicare. I can remember when the cover story on Time magazine was that the population under 18 was the fastest growing segment of the United States population. I was in high school at the time. Now, that population was 50% of the United States population back then. It's now 20%. And the fastest growing segment of our population now are people over 100. And because most chronic illness is age related, there's a lot of studies out there showing that this problem is just going to get much, much worse. Now, can we innovate in time to deal with it? I think the answer is going to be yes, we can. I think we already have programs. I want to put a plug in for Center to Transform Advanced Care, which we are just forming in Washington, D.C., that's looking at the kind of care models we're talking about, and finding ways to study them and finance them. That organization has just grown like crazy. We haven't even announced publicly that we exist, and we have a lot of interest. I think the innovation is there. I think now we need to have the burning platform mentality of we've got to find different ways to pay for care that currently isn't reimbursed. I didn't really answer your question long ago. Do we get paid for these new services? The answer is no, we don't. We're supplying a lot of especially nursing and social work services that we provide for nothing to keep people out of the hospital so that we lose out on that revenue also. It so happens if you total up all the dollars, we save so much in costs that it makes up for all that. But we lose money. Medicare and the payers, we save at last count about $1,250 per person enrolled in our program per month. That's about $15,000 a year in savings per person. And we've had 6,000 patients in this program. I ran the numbers and looked at what would happen if we saved Medicare 10% of what we could save, and it was around $23 billion. And that's if we're off by an order of magnitude. It could be much more than that. So we need to innovate in the reimbursement realm as well as just the clinical side.
And, Margo, do you think those kinds of savings are possible in the public sector as well, given that your population is maybe a little bit more complex, well, in some ways, than
I mean, I think in some ways we might even have more to gain, you could argue. I think we have a really dramatic problem with folks who are using it for things that could have been prevented. And I think for us it's two things. It's money, but it's also an opportunity cost that as health reform happens, we're going to have very happily more people to take care of, more people who have been sort of shut out of the system are going to be brought into the system. And for us to have the capacity to care for all of the newly insured people coming 2014, we really need to focus on not on, you know, containing care that isn't helpful to people.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but the panelists will be here afterwards if you want to come up and ask them some more questions. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Margo Kuschel, Associate Professor of Medicine at UCSF School of Medicine, Dr. Cheryl Phillips, Senior VP at Leading Age, Dr. Brad Stewart, Chief Medical Officer of Sutter Care at Home. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Sarah Varney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.